All right. What is going on, my brothers and sisters of YouTube? Welcome to another edition of the Common Law Rights Society Presents Carlton Weiss Private Trustee Handbook Administration under the Common Law. I just probably paraphrased that, but this is the third video in the series, and we're excited to bring this to you guys. We found that in researching your rights, and all your natural rights, and getting everything that God gave you back in your life without being limited by statutes and codes, we found that trust law is at the foundation, and we found that the private express trust under the common law right of contract is the most secure way to get those rights back and to keep them and to work within the system still. So let's go ahead and get started. So we're going to go ahead and go over to the handbook. This is page 8 in the 2008 Weiss Concise Trustee Handbook. All right, let's move this out of the way here. All right, so we're going to be talking about certificates today. Again, this is page 8. If you want to turn to your own copy and take a look at what we're reading. All right, what may come as a surprise is that any trust may divide its trust property into shares and issue certificates. All right, so whatever the property is, you could issue shares and certificates to represent percentages of this trust property. Excuse me. The power to issue certificates and bonds and employ the use of an official seal never has been restricted to corporations. It is well-settled law that whatever else most corporations possess beyond their artificiality and right of suit in a corporate name is a mere incident or consequence of incorporation and not a primary constituent. In fact, most attributes now commonly held as corporate in nature, such as the power of issuing transferable shares, limiting liability of officers, using an official seal, making bylaws, purchasing land and chattel, are merely the legislative recognition and adoption of natural common law rights any man or woman sui juris may exercise without permission, much less a charter from the state. The court in Warner versus Beers clarified this principle most effectively. So I hope you guys are paying attention there. Let's go ahead and see what Warner versus Beers says. There are several very useful and beneficial accessory powers or attributes very often accompanying corporate privileges, especially in moneyed corporations, which in the existing state of our law, as modified by statutes, are more prominent in the public eye and perhaps sometimes in the view of our courts and legislatures than those which are essential to the being of a corporation. Such added powers, however valuable, are merely accessory. They do not in themselves alone confirm a corporate character and may be enjoyed by unincorporated individuals. Such a power is the transferability of shares. Such too is the limited responsibility or liability. So too the convenience of holding real estate for the common purposes, exempt from the legal inconvenience of joint tenancy or tenancy in common. Again, there is the continuance of the joint property for the benefit and preservation of the common fund, indissoluble by death or legal disability of any partner. Every one of these attributes or powers, though commonly falling within our notions of a money corporation, is quite unessential to the legality of a corporation and may be found where there is no pretense of a body corporate. Nor will they make one if all were combined without the presence of the essential quality of legal individuality, right? A charter of some sort. All right, let's see if there's any thing that they had, Carlton had in the footnotes here. All right, so. All right, so under side note 35, he says, as a side note, the right of an individual using a seal has never been challenged based upon the universal understanding that it is used as a matter of right. Once the trustee has adopted the seal and has used it, it is automatically presumed that the use is lawful until proven otherwise. See Johnson versus Crawley. as well as Melanfany versus Scott. All right. The trustee of an express trust is empowered by the terms and provisions of the trust instrument to issue certificates not only of beneficial interest, but also of capital interest. Generally speaking, beneficial interest is that which is held by the beneficiary of the trust, who is entitled to a certain proportional share of the trust assets during the life or at the termination of the trust. So a beneficial interest, just as a side note, the beneficial interest can be assigned to be collected at the termination of the trust or during the life of the trust. So if you're creating this trust and you can make this trust a 20-year long trust, then the assets don't need to be given out necessarily as far as the physical assets of the trust or the corpus, the body, the original capital, don't need to be dispersed until the life of the trust has been terminated, which could be up to 20 years. Okay, and let's continue. While capital interest is that which is held by the exchangers who has invested property into the trust and thus becomes entitled to a certain proportional share of any profits and assets remaining at the termination of the trust. So once again, someone who is an exchanger receives capital interest for the amount of invested property that they put into the trust. But again, they don't necessarily receive this until the termination of the trust. They could receive other benefits during the life of the trust, but it's not necessarily going to be the capital property that was initially put in. And again, you guys, a private express trust can be molded into any shape and form that you want, as long as the beneficiaries do not control the everyday affairs or the property of the trust. And we'll get into that here in the next paragraph. As a rule, the terms and provisions of the trust instrument control the manner in which beneficial and capital interests are to be administered. It should define the rights of interest holders who, incidental to their acceptance of the interest, are bound under the trust instrument to that extent. But there are certain principles which govern these interests in construing the fundamental classification of the trust. For instance, it is held that where the certificate holders have control over the trust property and or administration of the trust's affairs, the trust arrangement is in fact a partnership, in which the shareholders become liable for the acts of the trust. So you see where that comes in, you guys? If a certificate holder actually has control over the trust property or administration of the trust affairs, then they're not true beneficiaries. They're not true certificate holders as in a private express trust. This actually, the courts would interpret as a partnership in which the shareholders, the certificate holders, become liable for the acts of the trust. Let's continue. The basic principle is that if it is free from the control of its interest holders, then it is an express trust. This is commonly referred to by the courts of equity as the control test, in which control must ultimately rest with the trustees of the trust in order for it to be properly classified as an express trust. The well-settled principle applied by courts of equity is that interest holders, by full legal title and control over the trust property, being vested absolutely in the trustees, cannot be considered partners nor agents, and therefore cannot be held liable for the debts of the trust in that manner. So if you guys hear what that Carlton is saying, it is, if you want a trust to truly work properly as a private express trust, you're going to take that property and place it out of your hands as far as the title of this property goes and into the hands of the trustee for the express benefit of the beneficiaries, whatever they may be, as expressed in the declaration of trust, in the indenture. The beneficiaries who can show that they have beneficial interest in their certificate or the capital interest holders, as they could show in their capital interest certificates. So you have two sets of beneficial interests. You have the beneficial interests of the beneficiaries, then you have the capital interests of the capital investors or the exchangers. But neither of these two groups can control the everyday administration of the trust itself, nor the trust property. If they do, the courts would not hold it to be a true private express trust. They would hold it to be a partnership, and those certificate holders would be held liable for all the debts and all the actions of the trust. All right. So Let's continue. Now remember that the beneficiaries cannot be considered partners nor agents, and therefore cannot be held liable for the debts. So that's important, you guys. This is not an agency. Nor is the trustee, I believe, an agent of the beneficiaries. It's truly a separate relationship. We'll continue on, though. All right. Let's see if there's any footnotes. Saying that you could also call trust certificates, certificates of trust units, and capital certificates, certificates of capital units. There's a bunch of court cases that are referring to what we were just discussing. All right, continue on. Page 10. Furthermore, the certificates have no determinable fair market value, and therefore no gain or loss is recognized until the cost or other basis of the property disposed of has been recovered. So we'll continue on. In Commissioner of Internal Revenue versus Marshman, the court held that fair market value is determined by property received by the taxpayer, not the fair market value of the property transferred by the taxpayer into the trust. So they're talking about that when they're talking about the idea of fair market value, it's by the determined by the property received by the taxpayer. But because certificates have no determinable fair market value, it can't be assessed as a taxable property. All right, so let's continue. What's more is that certificates are considered not necessarily as chattel, but as documentary evidence of ownership and intangible rights. So it's just evidence of ownership, just evidence of intangible rights. And that could be, just as a side note, used as in reference to the Constitution, because we do believe and we do feel like with good knowledge, we know that the Constitution is in fact a trust document. The citizens are the beneficiaries, the fiduciaries slash trustees are the magistrates and all the delegates, right? So your birth certificate could be seen as documentary evidence of ownership and intangible rights. So you have intangible rights of the Bill of Rights. You have ownership of, I don't know what that would be, your ownership of your, again, your sovereign rights maybe. All right, so let's just take that as a side note. Again, none of this video is legal advice, you guys. Let's continue. But as documentary evidence of ownership and intangible rights, and in and of themselves, they are only personal property, not the actual interest or share itself. So the personal property is just the document of the evidence of the ownership. They're not actual interest or shares itself. The interest in an express trust cannot be traded without the approval of the trustee. This is contrasted with the certificate of stock, which courts have long held may be dealt with in the market as a commercial document of value. So stocks are considered actual value, actual taxable commodities, I believe. And the evidence of certificates of interest are not. Again, you guys, you could correct me if I'm wrong in the footnotes. I'm sorry, in the comments below. Please do so. Anything that you perceive incorrectly through my presentation of the subject matter or of this trustee handbook is to be taken upon my fault and not, as Carlton says, the fault of the private express trustee, private express trust. All right, so trustee basics. First and foremost, any one man or person capable of taking physical possession of or legal title to property can be a trustee. And there's no limit to the number of trustees who may serve in any one trust. Generally, where there's more than one trustee, the trustees with respect to each other are referred to as co-trustees, and when acting jointly as a collective body are referred to as the board of trustees. There is no law prescribing the character of a trustee, although while it has been held that a trust cannot be invalidated simply due to incompetence, the trustee should be at least someone capable of and fit for executing the powers and duties honorably. This is the basis for the general rule that beneficiaries are not desirable as trustees, though there is no law to forbid such appointment. What does it say there? This is the basis for the general rule that beneficiaries are not desirable as trustees, though there is no law to forbid such appointment. Equity will generally avoid all temptation to a breach of trust. So I always thought that beneficiaries, as we were stating before, cannot do anything within the manner of directing the trust. Although he's saying right here, there's no law that forbids it. But I do think that the courts certainly frown upon it, you guys. The trustee should be stationed within the jurisdiction of the court of equity in which the estate is located, if indeed the trust corpus is an estate. But we're not talking about necessarily that, you guys, although that's fine. But where the trust corpus is portable land, which we're talking about a piece of gold, the trustee need not be stationed within any single jurisdiction. Non-residency will not disqualify or preclude the trustee from carrying out his position. So that's important, you guys. We're talking about making a, oftentimes, I appreciate the idea of making a trust that you could cross boundaries with and be able to travel with and not be bound to one jurisdiction. Let's go ahead. Pause this for a second. All right, I'm back. All right, so let's continue on. We are on page, where are we? Excuse me. Where did my cursor go? Page 11, I believe, right? Okay. As far as accepting the appointment is concerned, this should be done formally, expressly in writing, even though it will always be implied if the individual intermeddles with the trust property or performs any act to carry out the trust. So that's important to remember, you guys. And it's also important as a side note to think about, what do they call those, adhesion contracts. Let's read that again, you guys. So if there's any times in life where you're thought that maybe you were all of a sudden brought in and as a trustee, maybe in court or some place, it says, even though it will always be implied, so maybe we're talking about an implied trust, it will always be implied if the individual intermeddles with the trust property or performs any act to carry out the trust. Once acceptance has been tendered, no court of common law or equity can prevent the trustee from holding that office except for breach of trust or a good cause dependent upon clear and lawful necessity. Removal must be procured pursuant to the provisions of the declaration or where no such provisions are made by decree of a court of equity. Besides that little side note I made about the possibility of the system tricking you into an adhesion contract and making you the trustee, forget that for a moment. Let's move on to the good aspects, the wonderful aspects of the private express trust. So even if it's not expressed in writing, you guys, it will always be implied if you, as an individual or someone who you're offering out the position of trusteeship to, if they or you intermeddle with the trust property or perform any act to carry out the trust provisions, once that acceptance has been tendered, no court of common law or equity can prevent the trustee from holding that office. So no common law court, no equitable court, no statutory court can prevent you from holding that office of trusteeship, except for your breach of the trust, which if you helped to either create the trust documents, the trust indenture, you can create it in such a way that you certainly are not going to be tempted nor... You're not going to make it so you're going to be breaching the trust, and you're not going to accept the trusteeship position of a trust that you're going to be tempted or anything to breach that trust. All right, so except for the breach of trust or good cause dependent upon clear and lawful necessity, removal must be procured pursuant to the provisions of the declaration. So they have to, it has to be proceeded according to the declaration or the indenture, or where there's no such provisions made by a decree of a court of equity. All right, so lastly, it should be noted that the office of trustee is not always a desirable one. When the trust instrument conveys a burdensome obligation, the trustee is miserable and at a risk of breach by failure to perform. When the trust instrument has been constructed poorly, the trustee is miserably confined and inhibited, and he may well be held liable for trust contracts with outside parties. The trustee has a duty of care toward the beneficiary And must harbor no biases or resentment in administration. Therefore, it is prudent to empower the trustee with enough discretion to carry out his position to the best of his ability and responsible creativity. To put it plainly, the settlor must truly trust the trustee to carry out his duties and use his powers justly. All right, so yes, if you are creating a company and you are putting trustees in charge of the business, of the everyday business of the company, you want to pick someone who is, you know, I mean, responsible and who's going to be fair, and you want to give them enough leeway in the trust indenture to be able to carry out the duties and whatnot for the trust, for the trusteeship. Now, if you want to utilize a trust for your own benefit as the trustee, so you have beneficiaries of this trust, but you are the trustee and you're benefiting from certain aspects of being the trustee, then you want to create this trust in a way that gives you the most latitude to be able to enjoy the administration of this trust, right? You don't want to be confined by your own trust, by the documents. You want to be able to give yourself broad latitude of abilities to administer the trust. All right, let's continue on, and we will stop here in a little bit. The powers of a trustee are divided into three categories: general, special, and discretionary. The general are all those inherent in trustees, virtue of the office, ordinarily conferred by trust law. The special are all those conferred by the trust instrument or the declaration, and the discretionary are those arising out of the necessity of personal judgment, though broad discretion may also be conferred by law and as well by trust instrument. And that's what we were talking about. It is well settled law that under a declaration of trust, the trustees must have all the powers necessary to carry out the obligation of that private contract which they have assumed. Let's see what that referring to in the footnotes. 62, Boyd versus U.S. and Silverthorne and Lumber versus U.S. So again, it is well settled law, you guys, that under a declaration of trust, only that particular form of operation, you guys, that form of entity, it is well settled law that under a declaration of trust, the trustees must have all the powers necessary to carry out the obligation of that private contract which they have assumed, which is why Article 1, Section 10 of the U.S. Constitution says that no state may interfere with the obligations of contracts. So no statutes, you guys. No statute can interfere with these obligations. That's why to you, some of you guys, you might see the benefit of being a trustee is because you're able to create that trust in a way that no statute can interfere with the obligations of exercising the functions of the trust. Furthermore, it is settled that the trustees of an express trust are afforded greater latitude to carry out their duties than ordinary trustees. So of all the trusts, you guys, from what Carlton's saying is that an express trust is the trust that gives the greatest latitude to the trustees. All right. A little footnote here. Lord Justice Turner settled the rule of law that first the court will have regard to the wishes of the person by whom the trust has been created, if expressed in the instrument creating the trust or clearly to be collected from it. If the author of the trust has in terms declared a particular person, the court in those cases conforms to the wishes of the creator. A breach of trust does not include a technical breach of trust, one made through mistake. The reasons are generally for guilt of willful breach of trust, waste or mismanagement of trust property, refusal to account to beneficiary, lunacy, drunkenness, bad habits, or carelessness which endangers the trust property, or improvidence. All right. The trustees are empowered to control every aspect of the trust according to the trust instrument and equity, and retain the power to remove even the beneficiary from the premises. These powers include, these are the powers of the trustee, you guys, but are in no way limited to, the power to bind the trust in a contract, especially where such obligation is implied by law, and the power to contract with the beneficiaries. The power to partition, exchange, sell, pledge, or mortgage the trust property, either in whole or in part. The power to lease trust property. The power to issue, exchange, or otherwise dispose of securities of the trust. The power to support the beneficiaries in all reasonable manner. the power to prosecute and defend in the trust's name or trustee's name, the power to make gifts out of the trust property, the power to delegate all unessential powers and duties, and the power to exercise personal judgment and every discretionary power not prohibited by the trust instrument. He may do whatever a man or woman may lawfully do according to natural right. Not according to statute, but according to natural right. The fundamental principle of law is that for every power, there is a correlative duty. The trustee, as a fiduciary to the beneficiaries, assumes certain basic duties outside of the management of trust property and other general duties aside from whatever specific duties may be conferred upon the trustee in the trust instrument. These duties include, but are not limited to, the duty to support the beneficiaries in any essential needs which it may have out of the funds which would otherwise be paid to it in its distribution. And if such funds are not available, the duty to accumulate any balance needed. The duty to refrain from taking advantage of peculiar knowledge or position when dealing directly with the beneficiaries. The duty to exercise the utmost good faith in all concerns of the trust, whether dealing with the trust property itself or directly with the beneficiaries in matters concerning the trust, including to care for, protect, and secure the trust property. Let's continue down and look at the footnotes. It should be noted that even though the trustee may have sold the entire trust estate, the trust is not necessarily terminated until all obligations of the trust arrangement have been fulfilled, especially the transferring of the proceeds to the interest holders. So the trust is not terminated until all those proceeds are transferred. And I've seen wills that have been created into businesses, estates, and whatnot that have been created in 20-year-long businesses out of a trust. It is a general rule that if without adequate provision, the trustees lease property outside of the powers granted to them by the trust instrument, such an act will constitute breach of trust. Again, it all comes back to the design of the trust instrument. So what he's saying there is, if you want to allow yourself as the trustee to be able to lease the property of the trust, you have to put that in the trust indenture. Or if you want to, in your business, allow the trustee who you're putting in charge of the business everyday operations to be able to lease the property, if they're managing real estate and you want them to be able to lease the property, you have to put that in the trust indenture. You can mold it into whatever shape you want, you guys. The trustee's fealty is to the trust, and all his acts must be governed by strict loyalty to it and the interests of the beneficiaries. Any act which is not in the interests of the beneficiaries is a breach of trust. So don't make a trust that is going to be easy to breach, you guys, and don't accept one that's easy to breach. All right, let's continue on. What are their duties? The duty to preserve, protect, and further the trust's interests according to the purposes designated in the trust instrument, including pressing all reasonable demands and prosecuting and fending off all claims and claiming all available exceptions and taking all available remedies and advantages in trust matters. When delegating unessential powers and duties, the duty to exercise at least a general supervision of the trust affairs and to perform any ministerial acts which require the exercise of discretion or judgment. The duty to keep minutes and separate accounts of the trust, even if kept in a book with other accounts, with minutes showing decisions and resolutions reached, and accounts showing the state of the trust and pertinent details of transactions, generally in the form of schedules of income received, income paid, additions to principal, deductions from principal, principal on hand, and changes in investment consisting of debtor and creditor sides. Upon acceptance of the trusteeship, the duty to secure and protect the trust property and documents. When investing trust funds, the duty to invest them securely so that they shall be preserved intact for the remainder man, and to invest productively so that they shall yield at least the current rate of interest to the life tenant, and the duty to concur with all co-trustees except where authorized to act individually. All right, that was the duties. Now the privileges and the liabilities of the trustee. Oh, where are we? Right. Still page 13. In addition to powers and trust and powers and duties, there are certain privileges, including allowances, you guys. Okay, so let's, you're going to enjoy this, you guys. This is a good part. So it says, in addition to powers and duties, there are certain privileges, including allowances, rights, and liabilities of the trustee. These are all those which are enumerated in the trust instrument and naturally extended to the trustee of an express trust. So it has to be noted, enumerated in the trust instrument, and it naturally extends because the trustee is working for the trust and the beneficiaries. As was noted earlier, certain restrictions placed upon trustees of ordinary trust do not apply to the trustee of an express trust, pursuant to the doctrine of greater latitude. And he says to see Ashworth versus Hagen Estates. All right, these, aside from those allowed by the trust instrument, include but are not limited to the inherent unquestionable right to full compensation, including reimbursement of all out-of-pocket and other expenses incurred in the discharge of duties. An unduly withheld reimbursement results in a lien on the trust for the amount plus interest. All right. The privilege of residing within the trust estate and allowance of rates and taxes, although the trustee has the benefit of residing in the house. All right, so that's a big one, you guys. So if you decide to place your house into a trust estate, you as the trustee have the ability and the privilege to reside within the trust estate dwelling. So you could actually utilize that house and write off the rates, the taxes, the everything as a benefit of being in the position of trustee. So as Rockefeller says, control all, own nothing, control everything, right? So right there's a perfect example. You don't own the house, you are the trustee and control the house, right? So you have the benefit of residing in the house because you're the trustee, and that's one of the privileges of being the trustee. The right to employ a solicitor for assistance and guidance in the administration of the trust, and in the case of any doubt or difficulties to seek the opinion of competent counsel. And in the case where the trust's accounts are intricate and complicated, to seek the assistance of an accountant to the charge of the trust. The right to apply to a court of equity for directions in the execution of the trust, or to obtain a declaratory judgment in order to establish the meaning and the intent of the trust instrument. The right to carry on in separate business for the benefit of the trust given certain conditions. The allowance of remuneration for loss of time under certain circumstances. The right not to be compelled by subpoena or review to produce and show records or books to outside parties. That's a huge one, you guys. You're not to be compelled by subpoena into a courtroom to produce or show records of your trust documents. The right to further limit his liability in particular contracts, even beyond the limitation made in the trust instrument. So you as the trustee have the right to say you're signing that as trustee and not personally. You cannot be held liable for it, to look to the trust property and not to you personally. The right to relocate, move trust property, or change the trust domicile. And the inalienable right to disclaim the office at the execution or resign at a later date. With regard to the personal liabilities of a trustee, basically the inherent liabilities and non-liabilities are all those incident to ownership at law and imposed or exempted under contract law. For it is a maxim of law, le contrat fait la loi, I don't know how it's pronounced. Therefore, a trustee's liability is largely determined according to the particular circumstances of the situation, especially contracts when the trustee has properly limited his liability via qualified signature. And he says, I will discuss this principles later. For now, we'll entertain the general liabilities, which may include but are not limited to. And then we'll stop after this, you guys. But he says, liability on all contracts made, whether signing as trustee or signing individually. Liability of removal for breach of trust, waste, mismanagement, or good cause shown in an action for removal in a court of equity or according to the trust instrument. Liability for losses sustained by the trust as a result of negligence. Liability for torts, right? And common law criminal and civil wrongs. So he's not talking about statutory criminal wrongs, common law, trespasses, and whatnot. So your trust documents, your trust instrument can direct you as a trustee to do certain things that may be against the statutes, but no statute can come in the way of the obligation of the trustee, guys. I'm not saying to do any common law, criminal, or civil wrong, or torts. I'm not saying that. Obviously, you would never do that as a good, honorable man or woman. But as far as your trust documents stating that you could do something that's maybe against statutory rules, that's at your own discretion, you guys. You have to make up your mind in regards to that. That's what it's talking about. And we're talking about footnote 88. What's he saying? See Loring Supra at 1, page 26. However, in torts and civil wrongs, limitation of liability is amply available as per fisheries company Supra. Common law crimes are strictly of an in personam nature, going against the officer personally. All right, so those are common law crimes going against the officer personally. Also liability in all cases of commingling of trust funds and liability for all mischief of his agents contracted to exercise discretionary powers. But the trustee is not at all liable for any losses sustained in the proper discharge of duties, and in the case of other losses due to negligence or tort, the trustee may be able to be bonded in the manner ordinarily used by executors and administrators. They are generally not liable for contracts in which liability was properly limited using the methods to be shown later. Such contracts may also encompass the codes and statutes of various jurisdictions, given that all man-made law is, by its nature, fundamentally contractual. The debts of the trust incurred requiring the creditor to look solely to the trust for payment. Conversely, the trust is not liable for the personal debts of the trustee either, except to the extent of attachability of the trustee's interest in the trust. The independent, non-preventable acts of co-trustees, of which he had no prior knowledge, the acts of his agents when properly contracted, taxes on the income of the trust, and lawsuits against the trust. All right, so that's where we're going to stop for today, you guys. Hopefully you learned something that you saw some of the duties and also some of the privileges of being a trustee. You also saw that in order for it to be a true trust, the beneficiaries cannot control the everyday operations of the trust or the property of the trust. All right. And that's it for today, you guys. I hope you enjoyed this content. That was Weiss's Concise Trustee Handbook, video 3. And next time we will continue on and we will talk about authorized representatives. All right. Have a great day, you guys. Hope you are doing wonderful. Keep supporting one another. Stay positive. One love.